This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Thursday, the 16th of January. Still no ceasefire in Gaza. We hear from one of Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition partners who wants the Gaza ceasefire to be just a pause in the conflict with Hamas. Grooming gang inquiries after all. We hear from the old Republican who spent years campaigning. Mark Carney, who used to run the Bank of England, launches his bid to run Canada, telling Donald Trump, "We can be friends with benefits." And an 11-year-old chimney sweep whose death led to restrictions on the use of child labour is to become the youngest person commemorated by the National Blue Plaque Scheme. 24 hours ago, Gazans and some Israelis were celebrating the prospect of an end to the Israel-Gaza war. But still, the fighting goes on. A meeting of Israel's cabinet scheduled for today has been delayed because, according to a spokesman for the Prime Minister, Hamas had caused a last-minute crisis by challenging some of the things it had already agreed to. Tonight, there are reports in Israeli media that cabinet ministers won't vote on the deal until Saturday. Another possible reason for the delay emerged a couple of hours ago when one of Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet colleagues, the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, appeared before the television cameras to say that he would challenge the decision. He said that his supporters helped to sustain Mr. Netanyahu's Likud party in power, but he announced he will resign from the government if tomorrow's cabinet meeting agrees, as it's expected to, although we now know it's likely to be on Saturday, that the ceasefire negotiated in Qatar with Hamas should go ahead. A vivid illustration of the divisions in Israeli society provoked by the war and by this deal was on display outside Israel's parliament, the Knesset. Those people were protesting against a ceasefire. These were families of hostages in Jerusalem calling for the government and parliament to approve the deal. Mr. Ben-Gvir is among the most controversial figures in Israeli politics, the leader of the hardline Jewish Power Party. He holds six of the 120 seats in the Knesset. Mr. Netanyahu leads a coalition government, a government Mr. Ben-Gvir plans to quit, but not a government he had said that he intends to bring down.
When you see and hear the dancing in Gaza, the joy in Judea and Samaria, you understand which side has surrendered on this deal. Therefore, if the reckless deal is approved and implemented, we, members of Jewish Power, will deliver letters of resignation to the Prime Minister, and Jewish Power won't be a part of the government and withdraw from it.
Itamar Ben-Gvir, his words spoken by one of our team. Well, Anshul Pfeffer is Israel correspondent for The Economist and author of Bibi, The Turbulent Life and Times of Benjamin Netanyahu. He joins us now. Welcome to The World Tonight. Mr. Pfeffer, can you give us an idea of what exactly is going on behind the scenes right now? How difficult are the conversations happening between Mr. Netanyahu and the parties who are helping to support Likud?
Well, Netanyahu has already given the instructions to Israel's negotiating team to accept the ceasefire agreement. They signed it, as you said, 24 hours ago. But his cabinet has yet to ratify the deal. And within his cabinet, there are far-right parties who are adamantly opposed to the idea of a ceasefire, of ending the war in Gaza. Now they claim that that Hamas still has to be beaten, and they feel that Netanyahu has betrayed them by accepting this ceasefire. And Netanyahu, as we know, is under pressure from incoming U.S. President Donald Trump to do so. So Netanyahu is torn between the parties which put him in power and the next American president with whom he wants to have a good relationship.
What about this suggestion that came out of the Prime Minister's office that the delay was caused by Hamas suddenly trying to renegotiate parts of the deal or walk away from some of the things they signed up to? Is there evidence for that, or is that a bit of playing to the domestic gallery, do you think?
Well, there's a bit of both. From what we know, there were some last-minute issues between Israel and Hamas over the specific identities of convicted Hamas terrorists who Hamas are demanding will be released in return for the hostage. So there was a bit of haggling over some of those names. But from what I've seen over the last day, it seems that Netanyahu was also using that in the hope of postponing both both these protests from his far-right allies, and perhaps somehow managing to wiggle out of this deal, which Donald Trump seems to have forced upon him.
The war in some ways has helped to sustain Mr. Netanyahu in office. How vulnerable is he likely to be, assuming the deal goes ahead and the threats by these various smaller parties are carried out?
So the moment the war does end, and it'll still take weeks at least, because this process of the ceasefire is, this, first of all, 6-week truce, and then there's a second stage in which a more permanent ceasefire is to come into effect. Until that happens, Netanyahu is still relatively secure, even if the far-right parties leave the government. The opposition has promised Netanyahu that they'll support the government until the last Israeli hostage goes free. But once that happens, assuming it does happen in a month or two, then Netanyahu is indeed vulnerable. He's vulnerable both if he loses his majority, so that there may be a motion to bring forward the election in Israel by almost 2 years. And then there's another thing that he's very concerned about. That's a National Commission of Inquiry, which he doesn't want to happen, since he fears that he will be one of the main people blamed for the way Israel was caught unaware on October 7 by the Hamas attack.
Anshul Pfeffer of The Economist. I have to say, your book was very well titled, They Remain Turbulent Times for Benjamin Netanyahu. Thank you very much. Well, Ohad Tal chairs another far-right party in the coalition government, the Religious Zionist Party, which has 7 seats in the Knesset. Bezalel Smotrich, a member, is Mr. Netanyahu's finance minister. Earlier, I asked Ohad Tal, who's currently on a visit to the United States, whether he shared Itamar Ben-Gvir's critique of this ceasefire deal.
Yes, of course. We're very unhappy with this deal. We think it's a bad deal. At the beginning of the war, we've set to ourselves 2 goals. One of them was to bring back all the hostages, and the other was to eradicate Hamas. This deal basically doesn't do any of these goals. It doesn't bring all the hostages because we're bringing back only 33. That's number one. Number two, effectively, we are keeping Hamas in power, which really doesn't make any sense. I can tell you that this is a bad deal. We will definitely not support it. We're still now debating whether it's going to cause us to leave the government or not, but we're definitely not happy.
You're still debating whether or not to leave the government. And I suppose the question is, why even debate that if you've decided you can't support this deal? Because this is a deal that the Prime Minister wants to happen.
What we're trying to do now is to minimize the problems with this agreement. We're trying to get guarantees that will ensure us that Israel will be able to go back, that the agreement doesn't mean the end of the war. So we want to make sure that the implication would be that we are returning to fight Hamas, and we will have a whole plan of how to finish the job, how to make sure that Hamas will be eliminated. If we will get these guarantees, we will stay. And if we will see that we're not getting these guarantees, then you are right. Then there's really no point of us staying in the government.
You may have heard Antony Blinken, the outgoing Secretary of State for the United States, saying today it isn't possible to defeat Hamas, and that after every Israeli military operation, Hamas recruits almost as many new militants as it loses.
If he believes what he says, then why the fight in the first place? There is no reason to fight anyone. It's a very sad joke that the statesman in his level doesn't believe that you can beat terror. That's a very sad joke.
But is it not possible that continuing the military operation turns some people who were not militants into militants, and that you can kill lots of people, but if you offer nothing else but that, then you are creating another generation of potential people who could attack Israel.
But I'm sorry, but that question is a horrible question. Because, I can tell you, Israel offers every day a better future for the Palestinians. You know that 20% of Israel... No, there is not going to be a Palestinian state. Okay. That's it. We've done with that. For 30 years, we've tried this approach of giving pieces of our land to the Arabs, hoping that will bring peace and stability and prosperity. It brought us none of these things. It only brought the opposite.
Can I put to you what has been said by one of those who lost a family member during the October the 7th, 2023 attack by Hamas? Udi Gurun, who you may know of, whose cousin Tal Haimi was murdered He says they should be ashamed of themselves, those who are opposing the hostage deal, the politicians who are opposing it. He was talking particularly about Mr. Ben-Gvir and Mr. Smotrich, who of course is from your party, the finance minister. He says they should be ashamed of themselves. These people who consider themselves religious Jews are saying no to a hostage deal that is going to save lives. They should just be ashamed.
First of all, I want to argue with a person that his relatives are in captivity, but we are against the deal because it doesn't bring back all the hostages.
Not all at once. Not all at once. But presumably, if you bring some back, and then the ceasefire can be extended, if both sides does its bit in this deal, then the rest of the hostages would be released, wouldn't they?
When you are bringing back 33 hostages and paying the price that basically takes all leverage from you, he might be very happy to get his loved one back home. But 65 other families will not get their loved ones. And this is something I cannot tolerate. If we really care about the hostages, we need to find a way to bring
all of them back. So is it better to bring back none than some? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying. I'm saying we should bring back everyone. And the
but
way
how
to
will you achieve that if the fighting goes on? Because we know some hostages have already been killed in the bombardments.
It's quite simple. If we will announce that every day the hostages, all of them, are not coming back, another mile, another kilometer from the Gaza Strip will become part of Israel. You'll see the hostages coming back. But we are keep fooling ourselves, imagining that we are negotiating with Switzerland. They're not Switzerland. They're from the Middle East with all their Middle Eastern mentality. And the only way to negotiate with them is taking the price that they care about, and that is land.
Ohad Tal from the religious party, Religious Zionism. Well, assuming the ceasefire is implemented, the two sides will conduct an exchange of Israelis held hostage in the 7th of October 2023 attack by Hamas for Palestinian detainees. One of the sticking points on the Hamas side is over who exactly will be released by Israel. The number of Palestinians to be freed is unclear, though the Qataris have said 33 Israelis will be freed in the first stage of the deal. Some of them, though, may already be dead. Sari Bashi is from the organisation Human Rights Watch and is based in the West Bank. Sari Bashi, thank you for being with us on The World Tonight. What exactly do we know about the deal insofar as the Palestinian detainees who might be released?
Sure. So the first thing I want to say is that both parties, Israel and Hamas, are essentially negotiating over whether they're going to stop committing grave abuses against civilians. And they shouldn't negotiate. They should just stop. Hamas had no right to kidnap people from Israel and to hold civilians hostage, and everybody, all civilians, need to be immediately and unconditionally released. And the Israeli government has been depriving folks in Gaza of humanitarian aid and preventing them from returning to their homes in northern Gaza. Those are two things that are supposed to happen as part of the deal, and I hope they do, but those are not things to be negotiated. Those are rights that people have. But to get specifically to the question of the Palestinian detainees, since October 7th, 2023, the Israeli government has been conducting nightly incursions in the West Bank and rounding up thousands of people being held without trial. And it has also brought over nearly 2,000 people that it has captured from Gaza, also being held without trial. There are currently 10,000 Palestinian security prisoners
so
being held in Israeli
detention
centers.
A lot of people who could be involved, but what do we know about the one? Do we know anything about the ones who are likely to be on the list? Are there any factors, any criteria that we believe will be applied?
Yes. So the parties have negotiated a kind of key in which the number and nature of Palestinian prisoners to be released depends on the condition of the hostages being released, whether they are alive or dead, and also on who is being released. So there is a promise, for example, or within the deal, to release all of the women and children who've been arrested in the West Bank since October 7th, 2023, in exchange for releasing the bodies of certain hostages. There are other kind of keys where if Hamas releases women, then female prisoners will be allowed out. In exchange for releasing men who are not sick or elderly, then Israel will release longer serving Palestinian prisoners, people who have 15 years left in their sentence.
Right, and that raises the question of Marwan Barghouti, who's regarded by some Palestinians as a sort of critical figure, any prospect of any political progress and any foundation of a Palestinian state. Is there any chance of him being released? He was arrested more than 20 years ago in the context of what was then Second Intifada.
Yeah, up until now, the Israeli government has refused to release Marwan Barghouti in previous prisoner deals. And in general, they have been very reluctant to release Palestinian political leaders who have the potential to unify the Palestinian leadership. And I would count Marwan Barghouti as part of that. So I don't know, it's up to them, sure. But it hasn't happened up until now.
Sari Bashi from Human Rights Watch in the West Bank. Thank you very much. Well, listening to all of that, the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen, who is in Jerusalem. Jeremy, what are you hearing about what is going on in the Israeli government right now?
Well, clearly there's a row going on between Netanyahu and the extremists who are to the right of him about the fact that they're saying he's not keeping his promises, that he promised this war would go on until Hamas had been eradicated from the face of the earth, or words to that effect. And instead, they find themselves negotiating a deal with Hamas for a phased return of hostages and ultimately a full withdrawal from Gaza. And that is actually not what, as far as they're concerned, was written on the tin.
All of that presumably would depend on getting past the first stage. Is there a danger that this deal is kind of signed off by the cabinet and there are the resignations and all the rest of it? It does the 6 weeks, but then at that point, everything starts up again.
Yeah, I think that's the danger, because it will get through the cabinet. He's got enough votes for that, Netanyahu, and there's a lot of pressure coming from the Trump White House in waiting. Trump wants to take a diplomatic victory into the White House with him when he arrives there next week. But longer term, when maybe Trump's attention has gone elsewhere, that first 42-day stage is, I think, getting to the end of that is going to be a challenge. And then getting to the next stage, which is going to be negotiated while the first stage is going on. And that phase, the second phase, is effectively meant to end the war, release all the hostages and Israel to pull out of Gaza. Now, that's something that the right wing pulling out of Gaza is very against. And it's over such a long time as well that I think past history shows that a lot can go wrong in a long multi-phase time frame that means that actually it doesn't get to the end stage, which the whole point of it is bringing an end to the war. And there is a danger, and senior diplomats I've spoken to are very aware of this and concerned about it, that actually at some time the deal will break down and the second stage may never arrive and the war will resume.
Jerry Bowen, as ever, our international editor, thanks very much. Coming up on The World Tonight, in the next 20 minutes, will the government's announcement of new local investigations into grooming gangs be enough to satisfy those who have been calling for a national inquiry? But first, David Lynch, the American director known for his dreamlike, often surreal filmmaking, and that TV series Twin Peaks, has died. He was 78. From Eraserhead to The Elephant Man, Dune to Blue Velvet, Lynch's films provoked admiration among filmmakers and put bums on cinema seats. But it was on TV where he directed one of his most intriguing ideas, Twin Peaks, set in a small town in Washington State filled with eccentrics. It followed an FBI agent, Carl McLachlan, part of the Lynch repertory of acting regulars, as he tried to find out who had killed Laura Palmer.
You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee. I've had, I can't tell you how many cups of coffee in my life, and this is one of the best.
Well, last August, David Lynch revealed that emphysema from lifelong smoking had ended his directing career. By then, he'd become an on-screen performer, including A Turn, his last, as it turned out, as another great film director, the eccentric John Ford. Well, Tim Franks from the BBC World Service NewsHour programme spoke to Oscar-winning actor Nicolas Cage this evening about his experience of working with David Lynch.
He was so joyful. He was a lot of fun. I mean, that seems like a trite word, but he made it important to enjoy yourself on the movie set. And, you know, before I worked with David, I was a very serious kind of method acting 19 on like Birdie, and I thought I had to torture myself. But David said it's not only important for you to have fun. It's necessary. The audience needs this. And he was a true American surrealist. He wasn't like it. He's one of a kind. So he's really going to be missed in the cinema, I think. He always had music playing on the set, and he was so free. He was so loose and relaxed, and he really was a joyous man with just a hell of a sense of humor, and so fun and funny to work for. And he used to always say, "Solid gold, Nick. That was solid gold, buddy." And
what's interesting to hear in what you're saying is that he was a man. I mean, he clearly had a very sort of particular vision, a particular tone that he brought to his work. And you might imagine that he would be this sort of driven monomaniac. But actually, you're suggesting that he came across as a sort of as an easygoing guy.
He knew how to control his emotions. Like, if he was angry, he knew how to put it in check, you know, like. I remember once, you know, sometimes you can get a song stuck in your head and you can't get it out. And I kept hearing that song, Spinning Wheel. I don't know who did that. Mama's a, I don't know. It's a horrible song. And I said to David, I'm going to sing it. And he would, don't do it, Nickster. Buddy, don't do it. Promise me you're not going to sing that song. And he was serious. And like, I almost wanted to do it just to prank him. And he was, I could tell he was going to get really angry about it because
it could get very
he
dark.
He didn't want it to mess up. Stay in his head and mess up his groove. But here's the thing about Lynch. He wasn't just weird for weird's sake in cinema. I mean, it was a true thing with him. It was honest. It was pure. It was a genuine expression. And I still don't know really how he did it, but he didn't force it. It just came out of him naturally. He made it mainstream. He made surrealism mainstream. I totally concur with that.
I was just going to ask whether you think that he is unique or whether Hollywood could cope with another David Lynch.
Well, I think David is one of a kind and he is unique. I don't think you can replace him. So that's my answer there. But he's largely instrumental for why I got into filmmaking. I used to see his show, his movie Eraserhead at the New Art in Santa Monica. I grew up watching that when I was in high school. So anyway, yeah, to answer your question, he's one of a kind and he can't be replaced.
Nicolas Cage talking to Tim Franks. Eraserhead actually took 4 years to make. It was a stop-start because back then, David Lynch, who's died today at the age of 78, had trouble raising money. Now, it's not the National Inquiry into Grooming Gangs demanded by the Conservative Party or indeed by Elon Musk, but the government must be hoping the rapid national review announced by the Home Secretary Yvette Cooper today, coupled with 5 local inquiries into towns known to have been affected, will quiet the media and political storm.
For too long, this horrific abuse was allowed to continue. Victims were ignored, perpetrators were left unpunished, and too many people looked the other way. And even when these shocking crimes were brought to light, national inquiries were commissioned to get to the truth, the resulting reports were too often left on the shelf as their recommendations gathered dust.
A sharp dig there at the Conservatives, who had failed to implement the recommendations of an inquiry held specifically into grooming gangs, which took place in 2022. Ms Cooper said Labour will do so, and before Easter will also announce the timetable for implementing the recommendations of the National Inquiry into Child Abuse, including the mandatory duty of everyone to report any suspicions they have of a child being abused. Well, today, 2 groups of grooming survivors attended meetings with Jess Phillips, the safeguarding minister, and shared their views on the government's announcement.
I wanted to listen to survivors, look at it from our point of view.
Please give us a government inquiry. We need this.
I feel like the weight of the world has been lifted off my shoulders. I'm satisfied for now, but actions speak louder than words.
Let's see what happens now. Let's, you know, see if they actually act on what they've said.
There will be 5 local investigations, one of which will be held in Oldham. Brian Hobin is an independent councillor there. He's long campaigned for an independent national inquiry. He made his vote to sustain Labour in office in the council after they lost control of the council in the local elections last year, dependent on the Labour group reversing its previous position and calling for an inquiry. Brian Hobin, welcome to The World Tonight. What do you make of what Yvette Cooper had to say today?
Thank you, Sean. Good evening. Yes, I think we need to welcome what's been done today. It's been a hard fight for the survivors, and we all, whilst a statutory inquiry would have been our ultimate aim. I think we've got to take this now as much help as we're going to get from the government. And now we need to cut out the noise now and start working on delivering this inquiry for the survivors with them fully involved.
You talked about the kind of inquiry it's not. And one of the criticisms that has been made, not least by the Conservatives, is that because none of these investigations is under the Tribunals and Inquiries Act of 2005, they can't compel witnesses. Those who do give evidence can't be required to do so under oath. And the inquiries won't even be able to force public bodies to disclose documents. I just wonder, with those limitations on their powers, what actually they are going to be in a position to find out, even at a local level?
Well, I think we've got to dig into the small print of what's been said today, Sean,
yep.
and deliver what the best that we can locally. Now, while I understand we can't have a Home Office-led individual inquiry in Oldham, we are going to get help from the Home Office, and we are going to get some funding from the Home Office. So we need to take that now as a bit of a gift, and the framework that we now put in place for the inquiry in Oldham, we've got to make it as sufficient and as robust as possible to satisfy the victims who are the ones in all of this that we need to work for. The politics needs to come out of it, and we need to get down to the nitty-gritty now. And yes, there may be stuff that we can't do in a local inquiry that we could have done in a national inquiry. But I'm hearing that it's not the end. It might not be the end. It might be that these other Oldham and these other inquiries may actually feed in to a later inquiry.
Right. So that door is still open. Sir Keir Starmer, who obviously himself is a former director of the Crown Prosecution Service, director of public prosecutions, has said that he thought some of the calls were really associated with the far right, these calls for national inquiry, that this was bandwagon politics. I just wonder how you, as somebody who's been campaigning for this an awful lot longer than Elon Musk, say, I wonder how you feel about that.
I think it was wrong for the Prime Minister to bring that far right mention into the equation, because it kind of labelled everybody, survivors, myself and my other colleagues that we're fighting this, as far right. And we're not far right. We're right thinking people, but we're not far right people, far from it. And I think it's a shame that he used that term. I think it's been tossed to and fro politically, and we need to get rid of that. It's being used as a tool against political parties, and they seem to forget the survivors and the anxiety and everything that comes with this being back in the public domain so high.
What about the community? I know the area where your pub is, at least I understand it, is a predominantly white area in Oldham, but are you concerned at all about the impact on the community? Or do you find among Pakistani Oldham residents as much as white Oldham residents that there's a desire to get to the bottom of this?
I think there are people, Sean, who would like to divide us and would like to cause friction between the communities. We don't have any issues in the community level across the Oldham Borough at this moment in time. It's not, we're not fighting each other, we're not against one another. And in fact, I've had Muslim people, Pakistani people contact me over the years saying, please get to the bottom of this because it's for the benefit of all our communities.
Brian Hoban.
It takes away the shadow from them if we do dig down deep. So I think we need to bring them people in. We need to speak to elders in other communities, and everybody needs to be around this table and on the same page. And I think that's where we need to take it now.
Brian Hoban, I hope everybody hopes that others who have influence in all of this are listening. Brian Hoban, independent councillor from Oldham, thank you very much for joining us. Now, he ran the Bank of England for 7 years. He may be lucky if he gets to run Canada even for 7 months. Mark Carney has launched his campaign tonight to succeed Justin Trudeau as leader of the ruling Liberal Party and thus as Prime Minister. Mr Carney had already hinted that he might join the race. Here he is on Tuesday night on The Daily Show on the Comedy Central channel, showing a side of his character rarely seen when he was Governor of the Bank of England. Host John Stewart asked him about US President-elect Donald Trump's suggestion that Canada could become America's 51st state.
I mean, the bottom line is not going to happen. We find you very attractive, but we're not moving in with you. It's not you, it's us. We do things a little differently in Canada.
Sure, I'm up for it. We're up for it. Whatever you do differently. We want to experiment too. What do you guys want?
We can be.
You want like.
We can be friends. There can be a few benefits, John. Friends with benefits, but not. I'm not going to commit all the way.
See what I mean? That was Mark Carney talking to Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. Live to Ottawa now, and Janice McGregor, who is senior political reporter with the national broadcaster CBC. Janice, so he's in the race. What's he saying?
Well, I was listening to your intro. You're talking about 7 months. Honestly, he may not even be prime minister for 7 weeks.
Good grief. That's
how historically low the Liberal Party of Canada is in the polls right now, just so your listeners understand.
Indeed.
It was interesting. The person interviewing him at his launch event, and curious, he did his launch where he's from, which is in Edmonton, Alberta, in Western Canada, not a hotbed of Liberal support at all. But that is where his roots lie. And
so he did it in what one might call conservative territory. Presumably that was very intentional.
Absolutely. And the metaphor was there as well, because he was at a community center adjacent to the hockey rink where he learned to skate, where he used to play hockey when he was growing up. And it was a presentation full of metaphors. The person who introduced him said that Mark Carney, rather than running away from a fire, as so many Liberals who are associated with Justin Trudeau have been announcing they won't run again, that Mark Carney was running towards it. Right. And indeed, this is a party on fire right now, not just domestically, but in terms of the threat from Trump. And he is painting himself as someone who's going to focus on the economy and has a plan to save it, and is a contrast in seriousness to opposition leader Pierre Poilievre. So we will see if that contrast is something that resonates.
I mean, he obviously has to win in the Liberal caucus before he gets any chance of being Prime Minister. But I wonder, is he that well-known publicly in Canada? Clearly well-known in the UK, because he was governor here in the middle of the financial crisis.
Yes and no. So in Edmonton, where the launch was, a sort of sassy reporter was going around with a picture of him asking sort of people on the street, you know, do you know this guy? And it was a bit of a joke at the launch event, because most people didn't, even in his hometown, even near the high school where he went as a kid. You know, he left Edmonton when he was 18. He had a scholarship to play hockey at Harvard. Then he went on to Oxford, got a doctorate, went into sort of investment banking, Goldman Sachs, you know, and then he's in an atmosphere that is kind of way up there compared to, you know, the ordinary kind of working and voting folk of here. But would it work? Would this appeal to him? Appeal to people? Well, the Liberal Party is looking for a savior. And it is not just the caucus of this party that's going to pick. It's registered Liberals across Canada.
Right.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. And just finally, briefly, we haven't got too much time left. Who are the other candidates we know about?
Well, the one that might be more known internationally is the person who is Justin Trudeau's deputy prime minister until just a few weeks ago, Chrystia Freeland, who does have a bit of an international profile, strong supporter of Ukraine, strong ally of other people involved in finance and foreign affairs and trade, famously sort of led Canada's renegotiation of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, someone that Donald Trump is not fond of. You know, the other people in this race, I think, I don't want to be disrespectful, they are MPs, but they are of a lower tier.
And we probably wouldn't
really
have heard of them in the UK.
Yeah. You would not. You would not. And the interesting thing about Freeland and Carney, I have to say, they are both from Alberta, but Carney is also the godfather to Chrystia Freeland's son.
Oh, that could be interesting. Janice McGregor of CBC, thank you so much. I hope we'll talk again before that race takes place. Now, finally, let's talk about something historical. George Brewster was 11 years old when he died, a climbing boy, one of the children sent up chimneys by sweeps to help to clean them. His death in 1875 was a catalyst for a new law, which meant he was the last climbing boy to die in England. The cause was championed by the Victorian social reformer, the Earl of Shaftesbury, a Conservative who campaigned to clean up the industry for 35 years. Jeremy Paxman nominated Shaftesbury on Radio 4's Great Lives.
In the old days, chimney sweeps used to hire. You could have been hired as a young boy. And terrible things happened to them. They got brutalised by the sweeps. They got testicular cancer, most of them, from sleeping on bags of soot. Shaftesbury did something about that. He saw that there was an evil here. He could see social evils when it would have been very easy for him to do absolutely nothing.
And that was Jeremy Paxman talking on Great Lives in 2019. Now, George Brewster is to become the first child to be commemorated as part of the National Blue Plaque Scheme. Joanna Hudson is an historian in Cambridgeshire who's campaigned for the plaque after finding about George and how he died. Joanna, thanks very much for being with us on The World Tonight. You must be delighted, but tell us how you first heard about him.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me on. So back in 2019, I sort of stumbled across this little known story about an 11-year-old boy who was an apprentice chimney sweep, as you know, known as climbing boys. And he was sent up a chimney in an old lunatic asylum, which is near Cambridge. And sadly, he didn't come down the chimney. He suffocated and sadly died. But, you know, as we all know, this is not an unknown story for Victorian England. Lots of children were put up chimneys, down mines, in factories, that sort of thing. But George's story is very different, because George's story made it to the local press and then made it to the national press, which sparked a national outrage and brought attention to the plight of the chimney sweep boys. And as you said, the Earl of Shaftesbury, the 7th Earl of Shaftesbury, who did a lot of great things of his time. And of course, Shaftesbury Avenue is named after him. Anthony Ashley Cooper, his name was, did some amazing things, and it was him that changed the law. Mm. And it was George Brewster was the catalyst now, for changing the child labour laws.
I understand it. I mean, you only knew about him because you heard about him in a pub quiz, and people couldn't answer the question: who was this famous local who wasn't that famous?
Yeah, it was a village quiz. And the funny thing is that, as you know, we're going to be putting the blue plaque up in February. And actually, on the 11th of February, which is when we're putting the blue plaque up, will be the 150th day anniversary of the day that George died back in 1875. And at that at the event, the people that did the quiz all those years ago are actually coming along the event. That's great.
You'll have the current Earl of Shaftesbury there, who's going to come along as well for the unveiling. But you don't have any Brewsters at the moment, and you're looking for some.
That would be amazing. I have done as much research as I can on the family tree to try and find some descendants of George. But unfortunately, I've kind of come to a dead end. And so if there are any Brewsters in the Cambridge area, that would be interesting if they were to reach out to me, and I'll see if maybe our family trees match up and we can find some people that that were related to him. But yes, the current Earl of Shaftesbury will be the person that is unveiling the plaque for us. That's great.
Joanna Hudson, thank you so much. Our email address, world.tonight@bbc.co.uk. If you are a Brewster in Cambridgeshire, we'll put you in touch. That is The World Tonight. I'm Sean Lay. Good night. Thanks for your company, and I look forward to talking to you again same time tomorrow.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to
speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.